Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Radiohead released their fourth album, Kid A, on October 2nd, 2000. To say that this album was a different kind of album for the band is an understatement. Gone were the guitar-driven sounds and melodies of the band's first three albums. They were replaced by electronic rhythms that were just becoming part of the new technological landscape. Music critic Stephen Hayden writes about the band's struggles to find a new kind of sound in his book, This Isn't Happening, Radiohead's Kid A and the Beginning of the 21st Century. Stephen argues that Kid A foreshadowed the world in which we now find ourselves 20 years later and fondly remembers his first foray into Radiohead's music.
I would have been around 15 years old, and I discovered them the way a lot of people of my generation did, which was from MTV. You know, their first big song, Creep, was in the MTV Buzz Bin, along with immortal hits like No Rain by Blind Melon and Hey Jealousy by the Gin Blossoms. You know, that's the context that Radiohead was in at the beginning of their career. They were like this sort of poppy alternative band that I think a lot of people expected to be a one-hit wonder. And, of course, that's not how it turned out.
No, not at all. I wish I was special,
but I'm a creep. In order to totally understand what we're talking about when we're talking about Kid A, you argue that we have to look at Radiohead's career before Kid A. And so it seems like a good place to start would be the night of lead singer Tom York's fateful mental breakdown. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and I feel like this is a pretty famous story in Radiohead lore, that when Radiohead was touring in support of their 1997 album OK Computer, which was really their major breakthrough. I mean, they had, of course, had the hit with Creep, but then there was this period where I think a lot of people expected them to, you know, be a one-hit wonder and fade away. And OK Computer was the album that really established them as like one of the signature bands of their generation. And so they were getting a lot of press and a lot of attention at that time. And I think as the tour went on in support of that record, it just started to wear on Tom York. And I think once he finally achieved the stardom that he had been pursuing for so long, he just found it to be really alienating. And there's this famous show about them playing a concert and they're doing a sound check, and Tom desperately wants to leave the arena and, you know, just to kind of get some fresh air. And at first he can't find a door to get out of the arena. He's walking around. He can't escape. Finally finds a door. He hops aboard, you know, a subway train. And he gets on the train and he realizes that, you know, he's in the vicinity of the arena where he's going to be playing a show. So, like, everyone on the train is Radiohead fans. Today, we escape. We escape. Basically, this ends up kind of being a metaphor in a way. I think that's why I led the book off with it, that Tom York literally cannot escape stardom. And he's trying to do that. So Kid A, in a way, becomes the vehicle with which he's going to try to maneuver his way out of there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did his breakdown, how did that pave the way for the making of Kid A?
Well, for one thing, you know, the song Everything in Its Right Place, which is the first song on Kid A, there's a line on that record where he says, "Yesterday I woke up sucking a lemon." And what that line refers to specifically is his facial expression the night of that show when he was having this breakdown. Like, because after the show, there was this moment where, you know, everyone was backstage hanging out, having this sort of triumphant moment after playing a great show. And Tom couldn't speak. You know, he was catatonic and he had this sort of fixed expression of horror and disgust on his face that he likened to the face that you would make if you were sucking on a lemon. So that is like a direct reference to that that's on the record. But I would say, just generally speaking, you know, when you look ahead to what happened after the band went off the road and Tom York started to contemplate the next record and think about writing songs, he really had this crisis of confidence and I guess of just like artistic direction, trying to figure out, you know, I don't want to be a guitar band anymore. I don't want to do what we did on that record, but like, what do we do next? Breathe, keep breathing. And the solution that he arrived at and the rest of the band was to just radically remake the kind of music that they were making.
Mm-hmm. And that song you mentioned, Everything in Its Right Place, as you point out in your book, that was kind of the breakthrough, the catalyst for making the album. Can you talk a bit about the origin story of that song?
Yeah, so that's the first song on the record. And when you listen to it, if you have any familiarity with what Radiohead sounded like before that, it doesn't really have any of the hallmarks that you would associate with the band. You know, there are no loud ringing guitars. Tom York's voice is not the sort of operatic, angelic voice that you associate with the first three Radiohead records. It's treated, it's buried in the mix. And he originally wrote it on a piano, and there wasn't really much of a response to it. But then they decided to play it on the synthesizer. And it's that very distinctive riff that begins the record. And I think it's like one of the great opening tracks of any album. And when they heard that song, it was just like, okay, this is what we need to do. You know, this is going to set the tone for the album, but it's also going to set the tone sonically for what we're going for. Because, you know, one thing I talk about in the book and why I think it's important to talk about like other Radiohead albums is that for as acclaimed as Radiohead is, they are actually a pretty insecure band, you know, which again, mm-hmm. with a band like Radiohead, you would think that by this time they've had so much success that they wouldn't have those kind of insecurities. But with Kid A in particular, I mean, the making of that record went on for so long because the material that they were producing, and they produced a lot of it, you know, enough to create two albums, not just Kid A, but also Amnesiac, which came out, you know, I guess less than a year later. They would record this stuff and they'd be like, oh, this is garbage. You know, we can't use any of this stuff. And then they would come back maybe 6 months later and have a change of heart, you know, and feel like, okay, maybe this is good after all.
Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that maybe that insecurity and that self-questioning and that doubt was, it ended up kind of being a strength. That
right.
Would that be fair to say, do you think, that it made them make better music?
I mean, I think you could argue that Radiohead would not have progressed the way that they did if they didn't question themselves, like, with every turn. Like, it would have been very easy for them to just make another record like OK Computer. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that self-doubt pushed Radiohead in more interesting directions ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Was there a clear vision among the band members for Kid A when they entered the studio? And how did those early sessions go?
No, there wasn't. And I think that was like a big part of the problem. There were a couple different sessions that they had. It started at the beginning of 1999. And they were in France at the time. And there's a song that they were playing. It was a very early song. At the time, they were calling it Lost at Sea. And it ended up on the record as In Limbo, which is a very sort of woozy guitar song with a really strange tempo. Like, it took a long time to figure out how to play that song properly. But, you know, just looking at the song title, Lost at Sea, it's so indicative of where Radiohead was at that time. And like I said before, there was this thing where they were actually recording, like, really good stuff, but they didn't like what they were doing.
Kid A was Radiohead's fourth album. It was released on October 2nd, 2000. Did it sound like the logical successor to 1997's OK Computer? And what did you think of it the first time you heard it?
You know, yeah, you got to remember that this is the year 2000. So it's like the beginning of the 21st century where there are all these fears about Y2K. You know, and I write about that in the book. That's something that, like, now people don't remember or they treat it as a joke. But, like, in the moment, like, there was, like, genuine fear that, like, we're going to have, like, a technological apocalypse. So I think in the moment, Kid A plugged into those feelings that were already there probably for a lot of people. But as I write in the book, you know, in the case of this album and really like any significant work of art, that like the meanings change over time. And I think that's certainly true for Kid A. Like there are certain things I wouldn't have been able to realize, you know, when I bought it in October of 2000.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I think, you know, one of the big narratives about Kid A is that it's an album about the internet, sort of information overload and people not really feeling connected to their own spirit or humanity because all this technology gets in the way and it sort of warps how we feel about the world. And I feel like in the year 2000, like when I thought about the internet, I was actually like, I love the internet. The internet was like this novelty. But like, you know, in 2020, the vibe of Kid A, you know, the paranoia, the sense of alienation, dislocation, the idea of like not really having context for like all this data coming at you and feeling perpetually confused, that is 2020 more than 2000, you know? And that's why like in the book, I call Kid A the overture of the 21st century, because I feel like there are things in that record that Radiohead couldn't have planned. You know, they just made a record.
During your research, did you come across a story from the recording studio that endeared you more to a song?
I mean, this reading about the making of like the national anthem was really fun. There's a story in there about how Tom York and Johnny Greenwood were basically coaching the musicians who were playing on that record because they had this like sort of jazz ensemble, or it was like a horn section, and you know, getting them to play the way that they wanted, because that song obviously is very chaotic, it's very violent, you know, there's all these sort of free jazz squawks on it. And Tom York said to one of the musicians that, you know, imagine that you're in a car and you get into an accident and you get out of your car and the other person gets out of their car and you're raising your fist and you're just about to hit them. Now play like that, you know? And I think it was that session too, like where, like, because I think Tom York was sort of acting as this like hyperactive conductor for those people, and like he was jumping up and down like so excitedly that like he like broke his foot or like fractured his foot, you know. So again, it just kind of speaks to the level of artistic commitment that was going on at that time, you know, that they were really going the extra mile to capture the feeling of what they were trying to convey in the songs.
These recording sessions produced two records, Kid A and Amnesiac, released 6 months later. In your opinion, did Radiohead get the tracklist right, or are there songs that would have been a better fit on the other record and any clunkers that should have been swapped out with many of the numerous outtakes?
Well, you know, there is a bit in the book where I created a sort of a fantasy playlist of like a 14 song album that was like the best of Kid A and Amnesiac. But as fun as that is to do, to kind of come up with your own version of like of this album, you know, to come out of these sessions, I would still take the versions that Radiohead produced. I think that Kid A and Amnesiac are pretty fascinating albums. I think Kid A is a better album than Amnesiac, but Amnesiac in a way kind of goes like the experimental tracks go farther, you know, like they're very strange. There's some very strange songs in Amnesiac, and then like the pop songs are catchier and prettier, you know. Again, like a song like Pyramid Song off of Amnesiac, there's nothing really like that sort of sweeping on Kid A. Nothing to fear now. But I think that was intentional. I think Kid A was consciously made to be a more claustrophobic, dark record, whereas Amnesiac is a little bit more dynamic and all over the place.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you write, quote, "As a work of art, Kid A arrived as a missive from an unseen time beyond the visible horizon, an inarticulate mishmash of garbled words and passive-aggressive electronics that eerily emulated the contextual wastelands of online communication platforms that were still several years away," end quote. And that, quote, "the vibe of Kid A, the uncertainty, the darkness, the abject fear that things will only grow worse, has felt like a constant in our world ever since," end quote. Was it that dark unknowability that made Kid A so intriguing at the time?
I mean, again, I think what I'm writing there is it's more of a retrospective opinion. But in terms of like the feeling about it now and like why it's considered like a classic album of the last 20 years, you know, as I write in my book, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that this album feels like our modern age. Nothing feels like Kid A, and nothing I think feels more like the lives that we live, especially online, than this record. And it just seems like, in the same way that people put on Sgt. Pepper to evoke the Summer of Love in 1967, that Kid A has that same thing for the year 2000. You know, it just feels like the time that it came out in.
Yeah. Stephen Hayden, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Hayden is a music critic and the author of This Isn't Happening, Radiohead's Kid A and the Beginning of the 21st Century. As always, you can find out even more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Dwayne Kennedy, Susan Napier, and Stephen Hayden. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pod. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Fantastic!
Brad Kohlberg is our producer.
Don't be afraid. I just want to help you.
Steve Gotcher is our technical and music director.
Actually, I'm impressed you made it this far. But I'm sure you didn't do it on your own.
Adam Friedrich is our showrunner, nay, executive producer.
Oh, fine. But look at this mess. Now I must acquire all new men.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon. That's when I'll be changing my name to Gord Doug. Be well.
Listen, if you can find a way to break the spell that's on me, then I'll break the spell that's on you. You got it?